Today's going to be a journey oscillating through some lectures, some concepts, and then practices to try these concepts on for size for ourselves. Boston! I grew up in the Boston area. So, hey, Boston. All right. Share screen. And I gotta start the slideshow from the start. Can everyone see, just unmute if you can. I don't know if it's set up that way. And let me know if you can't see the screen. But Serena and I tested it ahead of time, so I think we're good. Oh, Connecticut, hello. I'll keep checking the chat. But if I get lost in thought and in practice, please raise a hand, an emoji hand, or even say, "Excuse me, Erin." I'm very happy to take questions along the way and have this be relational and interactive. So just inviting that kind of frame around our time together. Keep going with compassion. That is the theme today. We are all human beings witnessing a profound amount of suffering. And we have more instantaneous access to the witnessing of suffering than I think we probably have at any time in humanity. The kind of interconnection, the kind of vicarious suffering that these bodies are holding, is quite disorienting and quite overwhelming. And this may not be your experience. I'm speaking from my lived experience and from the community I sit inside, feeling into this large-scale sense of suffering and what can at times evoke a nervous system feeling of inability to cope, that we are beyond our capacity to bear witness, beyond our capacity to cope. You see a starfish on the screen, hopefully. And some of you may be familiar with this little story I'm about to tell. I'm a psychotherapist by trade in Santa Fe, New Mexico. Obviously, I teach mindfulness as well. I teach a little bit of yoga. That came along later in life as a bucket list thing when I turned 50 4 years ago. But in incorporating all of these different practices to serve my mission of trying to relieve a little bit of suffering. This starfish story I'm about to tell you came my way when I was in grad school for social work. And here goes. So these folks are walking along the beach, and it's just a couple of people. And one of the people, the beach is just littered with starfish, thousands of starfish, all stranded on the beach. And the tide is going out. And one of the people walking along the beach starts picking up the starfish and throwing them into the water, one at a time. And this person's partner says, "What on earth are you doing? You cannot save all these starfish scattered and littered upon the beach." And the person's like, "Yeah," and keeps throwing the starfish back into the water. They keep going. And the person who really thinks that the other guy's crazy for throwing these starfish into the water, she says, "Why bother? Why bother? You're not helping. You're not helping." And the person throwing the starfish in picks up a starfish, throws it in the water, and says, "I helped that one." So maybe you've heard that one before. I love that little story because it gives me a sense, yeah, we cannot save all the starfish. Our nervous systems are not built to save all the starfish. And I'm looking in the chat. It looks like there's some comments. Yvonne says that 100% resonates. Yeah, we can do what we can. I This quote has been attributed to a lot of people, but I think it's Arthur Ashe. We can do what we can with what we have where we are. So just a little compassionate lens to start our journey here today, differentiating between empathy and compassion, which are often commingled and confused, and find ways to hold these hearts that are built for caring, that are built for wanting to be of benefit to our fellow humans, but can often feel frozen by the overwhelming nature of how much suffering we are witnessing and are exposed to. Okay, so this there, I'm going to offer up some shared language in the beginning that will help us all kind of be in the same space together. We have motivational systems baked in, wired in, from evolutionary biology. We have an understanding of what motivates us as human beings. When we are under threat, there is a hierarchy of motivation. We default in this hierarchy of what motivates us. Number one, when we're under threat, we tend to move into fight or flight, this bubble of threat focus, protection, and safety seeking. So, fight or flight, we go into our stress response and we either want to attack the problem, or we perceive the other person as the problem. We want to attack another person to defend ourselves, is really the impulse. Or if we feel we're going to be overpowered, we try to run away from the situation. This is our immediate response in our nervous systems when we confront threat. Number two down the line, we get busy. We move into productivity, into achievement. And this is much more pro-social, but at the same time, this is where we can get into activities of busyness, activities of problem-solving and fixing and forcing when the situation at hand might not actually be served by that. But this is our primitive biology, our primitive psychology, our primitive neurobiology, saying we either need to fight this, run away from this, or fix this. Third down the line is turning towards, tend and befriend, rest and digest. Not as essential, actually, for our survival as these first two default modes of motivation in our neurobiology. And at the same time, I think we are in a moment where this needs to move up the line. And that is where our mindfulness practice and our metta practice, our loving kindness practice, to move this mode of tend and befriend, diplomacy, working together, finding solutions in a pro-social and productive way, we need to feel safe. We need to be able to feel that we can be seen and heard and have productive communication. We need to feel safe in our bodies. We need to feel that we are in community with allies rather than adversaries. And yet, from a neurobiological perspective, this doesn't necessarily come naturally to us in terms of what motivates us for our survival. And yet, I posit today that tend and befriend is fundamental for us going forward in terms of how we continue to bear witness and how we continue to solve problems together. The beauty of this is that our mindfulness practice is a gateway into finding more access to our tend and befriend and cultivating more safety, connection, well-being in our individual relationships, our interpersonal relationships, our intrapersonal relationships. I think most of us can name that we tend to even be at war inside of ourselves from time to time. How do we expect to get along with others when we have such a hard time getting along with number one? So it is essential. We can only get there through practice to tend and befriend. Mindfulness, the path of mindfulness can help us bring this third essential motivational system online. This is just a little nervous system refresher, shared language again. If you've ever been in a lecture with me before, you've seen this slide. I don't even remember where I found it, honestly. I think I Googled nervous system. I probably need to find the original artist of this. But on the left, there's our stress response. What happens when we are in danger, when the fight or flight kicks in because we're under stress, or we've been under toxic stress for so long, or we've lived in contexts that lack safety because of our social identity, because of our family of origin, you name it. Context can create, and I move into the chat. Context can create. Oops, I'm not seeing who came up in the chat. Sorry for the distraction. Maybe I will wait and look at the chat and not just, have my squirrel mind go to the chat every time I see it light up. So on the left, here are some of the things that happen activated by our autonomic nervous system. This is the part of our nervous system that makes our heart beat and helps us digest. And we don't have to do anything for these functions to happen. We don't have to think about them. Our body is one of the most self-compassionate instruments in the world because it's constantly taking care of us. I like to say that the sympathetic nervous system, even though it's associated with the stress response, it's sympathetic because it's taking care of us. It's trying to get us out of trouble. It is sympathetic to us. The parasympathetic nervous system is what kicks in when we're out of danger. Our breath slows down, our heart slows down, our digestive systems come back online. And we know in the last couple decades of research that this isn't just a one-way street from the brain down to the body. If we slow down our breath on purpose, it sends a signal back up to the mainframe that we're out of danger. So extending our exhale on purpose, like we did in the beginning of this practice time together, can actually bring our parasympathetic nervous system online. So anytime you need to give yourself a little self-soothing, your nervous system is reading the cues of the room, of the people you're in relationship with as dangerous. And this is a mismatch. I want to qualify this. When you're in a situation, a social situation, you're about to do public speaking, you're actually in a context of safety. Extending your exhale longer than your inhale can be a helpful friend, it can be a self-compassionate act so that you can bring your prefrontal cortex, your reason, your judgment back online and tend to the work at hand. I will give a definition of regulation, self-regulation here that I feel is really important to name. Self-regulation is managing your mood and your behavior appropriate to context. And so if that context is one of danger and you need to flee and you need to fight or you need to be angry or you need to appropriately express rage, thank goodness that this is just you're gonna default into that. We do not want to gaslight ourselves in an unsafe, our nervous systems in an unsafe situation by regulating ourselves, down-regulating ourselves in a way that's not skillful. So I like to name that as we look at this slide of stress, upregulation, sympathetic nervous system, fight or flight, soothing, affiliative, safety, connection, calm, parasympathetic. And we're moving through these states all day. Stress is not necessarily negative. Stress motivates us. Stress helps us take care of business. It helps us solve problems. It's just when we're exposed to so much vicarious challenge, suffering, trauma on a daily basis, it can be very hard, even when we're in a context of safety, to be in our parasympathetic nervous system response. And when the rest and digest part of our nervous system, when we're out of whack and out of balance for too long, it can create disease. It can create inflammation, And lead to all kinds of problems, as many of us know. Okay. I love differentiating between empathy and compassion because I think that these two get conflated. This comes from the research of Tanya Singer and Olga Klimeki, who define empathy. I mean, you can read it for yourself. I'm shrinking my screen because I can't see my whole screen here, but I'll come back so I can see your faces. Empathy, with empathy, we are feeling with another person. Many of us are familiar with mirror neurons. When we are witnessing the suffering of another, with empathy, we feel it as if it is happening to us. This is also true for positive emotions. We have contagion in our nervous systems, in our neurobiology. We are wired not only on a cognitive level, but on a physical level to be feeling with our fellow humans, hopefully to motivate, to be of service, to act in a pro-social way, to take care of others who we're in community with. That's where compassion comes in. Compassion is empathy with an altruistic wish. Empathy is the feeling in and of itself. Compassion, we add an altruistic wish. And with compassion, there is more of a sense of being able to act. So here's a visual on that. Empathic resonance is not just bearing witness to something that's happening for someone, but you are bearing witness, and inside of your body system, you are feeling like it's happening to you, and it can make you feel quite helpless and powerless. Compassion can restore a sense of agency. And folks on here might be familiar with Matthew Brandsilver, who is a teacher at UCLA, a Dharma teacher. I really liked how he framed this nuanced difference between empathy and compassion. With empathy, there can be a bit of pain. Compassion is painless. So I'm going to come back to this slide. Actually, I want to share a little bit about Matthew Ricard, also maybe familiar to many folks here. Matthew Ricard is a Buddhist monk and also a neuroscientist. This was, oh gosh, I have the resource on the end slide. This slide comes from a lecture by Ron Siegel. The study itself, we can share with you. I think Serena actually might have a link to it because we've talked about it before. So Matthew Ricard was in a research study. He was the research subject, as you can see here. The study around empathy and compassion, they had Matthew look at a bunch of slides witnessing people's suffering. And they asked him, as part of the research study, to simply witness with empathy. And then they were, with all those fMRI stickers on his head, they were looking at what areas in his brain were lighting up. So he's looking at the suffering, and he's been recommended or instructed to work with empathy alone. And what they witnessed were the areas associated with pain, with threat, were lighting up in Matthew's brain. So the amygdala was flaring, all of the different compartments of the brain associated with threat and pain were lighting up. I don't know the exact time on it. I think it was something like an hour of doing this. He said to his the researchers engaged in the study with him, Whew, I can't do this anymore. May I please practice some metta? May I please practice some compassion practices? I am in a lot of pain here just working with empathy. So they went through the same slides, switched it up, and he practiced metta, watching the same slides. And something very interesting happened as they witnessed the different areas of his brain lighting up. Instead of the areas of the brain that were associated with, oh great, I see that Serena put the research study in the chat. Instead of the areas of the brain associated with threat, with the sympathetic nervous system sending messages from the limbic system, what lit up instead were areas of the brain associated with maternal love and actually the reward systems in the brain. And Matthew said, you know, with compassion, I can practice with this forever. Empathy alone is a way to burn ourselves out. And the conclusion of this study was we need to teach everyone in the helping professions, doctors, nurses, social workers, therapists, you name it. And I think we need to teach the world this because we are all on empathy overload, practices for compassion so that we can keep going. And I'm going to go back to the prior slide. So when we meet the suffering of others with empathy, it can go in two different pathways. Often there's this pathway of personal distress. When we feel this harkens back to the motivational systems slide. When we feel personal distress, what kicks in is the default motivational systems. The default motivational system of trying to get out of trouble or avoid trouble, run away from it. So empathy can move us into personal distress, which actually moves us away from wanting to caretake, wanting to tend and befriend, wanting to move into that third motivational system. When we have empathy and we add compassion, that helps us turn towards tending and befriending, and it cultivates positive feelings, pro-social motivation to caretake, to relieve the suffering of others. And maybe there's some personal resonance here when you witness something really difficult and you can feel the personal distress that it's evoking. And you're not alone in this, and I have felt this myself. We tend to move towards emotional avoidance, distracting ourselves, using substances, shopping, scrolling, just anywhere but here. With compassion, we're able to stay with it. May your suffering cease. May you be well. Something about saying these phrases restores agency in the face of personal distress, which then in turn can help motivate us to stay, to contribute, to be able to have the capacity to continue to bear witness. And I will check in on the chat real quick. And I'm not sure. It says refreshing the page did not help. Are people not able to see the slideshow? I'm going to let Serena address that. Okay. All right. So compassion versus empathy. And it's interesting because I'm a therapist and I have plenty of friends who are not. And they're like, I don't know how you do it. I would just be so sad and be drowning in all of these emotions of, the suffering. It says you can't see me, but can you see the slideshow? That's the important thing, I think, right in this moment. All right, Serena, I'm gonna let you figure out the tech difficulties here. 'Cause it feel yeah, okay. I'm just gonna have some compassion for myself and my distracted mind. Thank you, everybody. I'm sorry if not everybody, if some folks are having some technical difficulty. So back to compassion versus empathy. I think if we practice with empathy alone, yes, a field like I'm in would be impossible to stick with. But from a very early stage in my work, I had an awareness around the differentiation between empathy and compassion. With compassion, that other directed motivation somehow takes you out of your own head, your own personal distress. It's not about you. It's about relieving the suffering. And there's actually some relief in that. You don't feel as helpless. So I want to give you an opportunity to try this on for size in your own nervous system, and then we can maybe have a little bit of discussion around this. Empathic resonance versus compassion. And again, I want to offer up the opportunity for folks to skip this. If you're feeling any tenderness, if you're feeling any overwhelm already in the face of bearing witness, I have created a slideshow that has both joyful and mildly distressing images. When I say mildly distressing, like the picture on the left with the young woman crying, I've made my best attempt to choose images that are not going to be highly distressing, but I do want to offer a disclaimer. You know, there's some sadness or some stress or frustration that are in these images. So if that feels like too much today, you've had enough, I understand. You can look out a beautiful window, breathe and be, and just listen to the sound of your voice, of my voice, and I'll let you know when the slideshow is over. But I want to make very sure folks do not have to engage in an exercise if they don't feel up for it. If you do, this can be an interesting way to explore what's happening in your own nervous system around feeling soft, feeling open towards images that might evoke a sense of safety and connection, noticing what happens, staying with empathic resonance. We're going to do two rounds with this exercise. I'm going to invite you to be like Matthew Ricard. In the first round, see if you can just attune to the emotion evoked by the slide that you're looking at without offering any phrases of compassion. Just stay with the emotion as you're feeling it in your body, your throat, your heart, your belly. Do you notice a tension or do you notice an expansion? And this is really, this first round is an exercise in attuning your own nervous system to the witnessing and paying attention, to what it evokes in you. And we'll do a second round with compassion to compare and contrast the difference that compassion can make. Oh, and before I was worrying about the tech, now I remembered what I wanted to share with you all. Well, let's try this first, and I'll get back to that. Okay. So notice what you notice: throat, heart, and belly. What's happening for you? And as we bear witness to these slides of both joy and sorrow, you can feel your feet on the earth, your seat in the chair, your back against the back of the chair. And I'll really just invite you to notice if you're shutting down, opening up, feeling tired, feeling energized, tuning in mindfully to what the slides evoke. Remember to breathe. All right, folks who turned away, the slide now has some meta phrases on it. You're welcome to return your attention to the screen if it's not there already. And I'll let you know when we're about to go back to round two. I'm offering these phrases, these loving kindness phrases, as possibilities for you to use as we shift through the slides on this second round. And as we shift through the slides this second round, I'll invite you once again to bring your awareness to your own throat, heart, and belly to notice a sense of tension or openness. And with this run through, how is that impacted when you offer up some phrases, some altruistic wishes for suffering to cease? And these are some possibilities. May your difficulty pass. May you get rest. May your loneliness cease. May you get the help you need. May you be happy. But there may be some that you want to offer on your own that work for you. And of course, the invitation to use what works. Folks who prefer to pass on this activity, it's time to look out the window again, take your attention elsewhere. Folks who are engaging will scroll back through. Offering compassion, meta phrases, when the more difficult slides or even the happier slides come across your window. Here we go. Stop the share for a moment. How's everyone doing? You doing okay? So I'm curious. You can chat in. I'd love to hear if anyone feels brave enough to share vocally in the Zoom room. I'd love to hear what you experienced. If there was some difference between the first run through versus the second run through, if you were able to notice any kind of shift. And really just, it's open. I'm curious what you experienced. Yvonne says the phrases did help with the sad slides, and she was surprised at the degree to which this happened. I know, it's kind of wild. Wendy.
Yes, thank you. With the empathic resonance, I felt something in my chest. Like, that's usually where I feel things anyway, so I felt that. But then with the compassion, it was like kind of more in my head. Like, I felt, I don't know, it was a weird detachment though, with the compassion. I don't know why.
Yeah. Can you say a little bit more about that, the detachment piece?
I felt like it was more watching a movie rather than being present in the moment.
Well, and I wonder if there's something skillful about that, or if it felt like emotional avoidance. And you don't have to answer that, but there's a part of me, my theory would be a little bit skillful because you're not. Brené Brown has this really good cartoon, I don't, about empathy versus compassion, or at least it's about empathy, where she has, it's like a fox, I think, and someone falls down into a hole, and the person like is like, I think it's sympathy versus empathy is the cartoon. So if you want to Google that, but sympathy is like looking down into the hole and being like, that looks bad. That's bad down there. And then empathy in this cartoon, they crawl down into the hole and they're like, hey, how you doing down here? I think I would probably say that's the more maybe compassionate response, or maybe the compassionate response would be another character that doesn't fall into the hole with the person. And I think there is a healthy amount of detachment in order to be of service when folks are suffering. There's a healthy amount of detachment that compassion, it can be like this really skillful boundary to be able to wish for the suffering to cease without being swept away by the overwhelm of also suffering at the same time with the empathic resonance. Yes, Donna, you just said more skillfully what I was trying to say. I think the phrases give you a degree of separation that makes you more useful. So, in 12 step they say detach with love. So detachment isn't dissociation, right? You're not avoiding, your emotions are still there, you're still caring, but you're not in the quicksand of the emotion and of the experience. When we show up for grief in my work, we say we can show up in these situations where we don't know the folks because our prefrontal cortex is still online. We can order the food. We can make the decisions. And you do need that level of detachment to be able to be of service. So thank you, Donna, for putting words around that. Marilyn, I'm not sure that it means you must perform an action to help relieve the suffering. And compassion, defining it as empathy with an altruistic wish. What I think is that when you start practicing compassion and it becomes a regular part of your practice and who you are, I think it necessitates action. I think it encourages action. I don't think it's a should, but I think that, or a must, but I think that when we practice compassion, it naturally inspires action. That would be my hot take on it. That's right, Donna. It's like putting your oxygen mask on before you help someone put their mask on. They do, absolutely, Steve. They do inform and complement each other. It's not like empathy bad, compassion good. It's like we have this empathic resonance. Compassion is a tool to help us harness the empathy and utilize it rather than be shut down by the empathy, which happens for a lot of people. Matthew says, when practicing compassion, balanced and centered. During the first exercise, I felt greater tightness and heaviness in the belly and throat. Yeah, I'm with you on that. Sharon, it's a fine line between having a caring heart and helpfulness and having people actively pull you into that hole. That is a very good point. And that is where like our super healthy boundaries and being able to have discernment around what is my part, what is your part. There's a lot of work we need to do in therapy and reading and self-help books and all this good stuff in order to learn what healthy boundaries are. I mean, I think that's why there's so much literature on boundaries right now, and it's in the zeitgeist of the, Instagram influencer world of like, the finding the sweet spot between totally loose, chaotic boundaries and the rigidity of like, being a fortress. There's some discernment and a case-by-case basis. Yes, I can, Joella. I will at the end. I'll put all my resources in at the end. Yeah, and the piece that I wanted to come back to around compassion and empathy and how I think it can help us be of service. I have a pet peeve, which is the phrase compassion fatigue. I have a real pet peeve with with that phrase because I think it's trauma fatigue. I think it's empathic resonance fatigue. I think we need a big reframe. I think we need to re-language, take back, compa it's not compassion fatigue. Compassion is actually the thing that can help us keep going. So when my friends who are not in the field say, "How can you do that?" my answer is compassion for myself, also knowing when I need to go have fun and put the oxygen tank on and, do all my self-care stuff, because without that, we cannot be of service. So yeah, lots of interesting, lots of interesting feelings, thoughts, actions coming out of this differentiation. And I will say, I've read the research, I've been to some lectures around this. I'm coming up with my own ideas of how to differentiate between empathy and compassion. I do think this piece around even that internal relief, going back to what Marilyn was saying, like Matthew Ricard, he wasn't actively doing anything to, help the people on the pictures that he was seeing. Just having that altruistic wish by saying a meta phrase, "May your suffering cease, may your difficulty end," it lit up the reward systems in his brain, the compartments of the brain associated with maternal love and, feeling good and safety and connection. When we are in that nervous system space of feeling safe and grounded in our parasympathetic nervous system, that is when we know our prefrontal cortex can come online. When we have reason and judgment, we're acting from a place of responsiveness rather than reactivity. So even though he wasn't actively helping anyone, compassion gave him more of the capacity to continue to serve in the ways that he does in the world. I think so, Wendy, that compassion, Wendy Wang, am I pronouncing your last name right? Wendy Wang says, "Does compassion also help us improve ourselves because perhaps it enhances our meaning and purpose?" Like, yes. Because when we feel helpless and powerless, we tend to feel disconnected. Why are you throwing that starfish in the water, kind of thing, right? And no, we can't save all the starfish. We can't help people on the other side of the world when a tsunami hits. Offering compassion in the ways that we can, where we are with what we have, can restore a sense of meaning and purpose. Absolutely. Absolutely. All right, folks, there's more. Do you have any questions about all of this stuff so far before I bring the slideshow back on? All right, folks who were not looking at the slideshow, I actually have to click through them again. So look away, finding something beautiful to look at. And I'm going to click through the slides again just quickly to get to the next section. Okay, it's over. And this is just a little snippet from the Matthew Ricard study. The piece I already named that the study encouraged, its findings encouraged, that training folks in the helping professions and I think in any human body, actually, right now at this moment in time, and of course, probably should have been taught all the way back to in time immemorial, but that's what our world religions have been trying to do, right? Love your neighbor, take care of each other, metta. All of our ancient wisdom comes back to love and care and compassion. So the conclusion of this study, training compassion may reflect a new coping strategy to overcome empathic distress and strengthen resilience. I think it's equally true for helpers as the general population. Compassion, compassion, compassion. All right, folks. I want to do a little exercise. Tee it up with another little story. So we just experience the contagion that we feel in our nervous system when we're witnessing difficulty. I hope you also felt a little contagion when you were witnessing joy. And I want to share this story about that I think will be illustrative and personally resonant to anyone who's flown on an airplane before. If you've not flown on an airplane, this will still pro you'll still probably say, yeah, that makes sense. And I always like to cite my sources. I heard this story from Chris Willard, but I've heard it from other teachers too. So it's kind of out there in the nervous system teaching world. Okay, so you're on a plane. Imagine you're on a plane, and the turbulence starts going, and you start to feel a little nervous, and then you start to look around at the other passengers. And they're looking nervous too. And then you look at the flight attendants and they're looking nervous too. And suddenly there's this collective sense of this might not just be normal turbulence. This might be, you know, this might be it. This might be the terrible thing with my plane that I've always been worried about. And our minds, as we know, can start telling us these terrible catastrophic stories. We're looking around and everyone's nervous. And then the pilot comes over the intercom and says, "Hey, folks, it's getting a little bumpy, but it's no big deal. This is totally normal. You know, just some normal turbulence. We'll be out of it in 5 or 10 minutes. So just, you know, relax." The flight attendants relax. Flight attendants relax. You relax. You look around. Everybody else is relaxing. And we're back at baseline, even though we're bumping along in turbulence. So there's just something very meaningful and powerful about that little narrative or that little visualization for me. We know this happens all the time. This happens in Trader Joe's. This happens in traffic. You know, this happens when some kind of weather event is going on. We look to our community to read the room. And often there's a complete mismatch to what's actually going on until we collect more data. Because our nervous systems are so contagious with the people that we're in relationship with and being in communities with others, if we are in a position of leadership or we are in a position of, you know, delivering some steadiness, it can be quite meaningful to practice with compassion, to practice with grounding, to practice with extending our exhale longer than our inhale when appropriate, when we are in a context of safety and we do have the facts that we are not in real imminent danger. Bringing our own nervous system online can have a very powerful effect on the folks around us. There is a concept in mindfulness, in the Brahma Viharas, in the four immeasurables. We've got our loving kindness, our compassion, equanimity, and mudita, vicarious joy. So a lot of what I'm talking about today is dealing with vicarious trauma, just to name it, vicarious suffering and the witnessing and the bearing witness of difficulty, which brings us into those motivational systems of fight, flight, fix. In order to practice cultivating more compassion, cultivating more steadiness in our own nervous system, cultivating more grounding, more joy, we can also move our attention into context. Onto objects for our attention that can cultivate a sense of goodness, safety, tend and befriend, rest and digest, which is essential for these bodies and the communities that we're in to keep going, to solve problems, but also to just cultivate peace by cultivating that in our own body and trusting through the beauty of co-regulation. There's self-regulation, bringing this online in ourselves. Co-regulation is one of my favorite things because it's passive. I mean, we can co-regulate by offering some instructions to another around how to bring their, ground themselves, center themselves, feel more at home in their body. And when we put our oxygen mask on first, when we learn how to cultivate nervous system steadiness, bring our parasympathetic nervous system online intentionally when we are in a context of safety, that can spread naturally, just body to body, without having to say a thing. Just like that pilot coming over the intercom saying everything's okay. And then you notice that the flight attendants are looking more relaxed in their body. They don't even have to say anything to you. Every other passenger on the plane, the flight attendants, your nervous systems all come into align, into groundedness without having to say a thing. That's co-regulation. That's a very, alive example of how we co-regulate in community and interpersonally. So, this is one of the things that brings me joy, a cup of coffee in bed in the morning. This is another thing that brings me joy. Although, actually, in this moment, it's bringing me a little bit of sadness because I'm not there. I grew up in Maine, yes, the Boston area, but also Maine. And this is Lake Damariscotta, mid-coast Maine. I have family that lives on this lake. I'm not going to get to go there this summer. My kids used to go to summer camp. They're 20 and 16 now. But this is when I go to a happy place in my mind, it's these glimmers on this lake in Maine. So those are a couple examples of spaces, places, rituals that bring me joy. And I want to walk us through a little practice here. So you can, we've gone through a bit of the empathic resonance on the difficulty side. Let's cultivate some positive emotions. If we're going to move in our motivational systems, if we're going to shift the hierarchy so we might be of more benefit to others that we're in relationship with, whether it's primary relationships or in community, creating more safety in this bodily system when it's safe and appropriate. Cultivating the tendon befriend in our nervous systems, bringing the parasympathetic nervous system online to balance out the overwhelming sympathetic nervous system state that most of us are in. We need practices for that. And so, offering up this actually comes from Deb Dana, who is a polyvagal therapist. Yes, there is controversy over the polyvagal theory. And this is a beautiful practice for bringing the soothing aspects of our nervous system online, created by Deb. And I would also like to offer, as a yogi, as a mindfulness teacher, the practices for soothing our nervous system. And polyvagal theory may not be familiar to folks, but for folks who are familiar and who are familiar with the controversy, I just want to name this, that these practices for soothing ourselves and for evoking different nervous system states, date back thousands of years and predate any kind of scientific theory that talks about being able to soothe ourselves, which is what polyvagal does. It's not all bad. But I just wanted to name that this is really ancient body wisdom more than science that's very controversial right now. Important to make these things visible when we're talking about different theories. But long story short, let's just have a little practice time here. Controversy, scientific quibbling aside, I'll invite you all to get yourself comfortable again in your seat of meditation. Maybe there's some more shoulder rolls. Maybe there's some more neck rolls. And then to allow yourself to be soft and heavy and supported in your seat. Gotta shift as the sun is coming into my eyes. And just turn your attention over to your body and your breath, the first foundation of mindfulness. Breathe into those tender places, breathe out and release. Notice your body as a whole. So, we've been practicing tuning into internal states as a way to check in with ourselves today. Where do I close? What kind of images, experiences, practices help me open, soften, feel safety and connection? This practice is an offering, something you might be able to put in your back pocket out there in the world in order to bring some soothing online to yourself when you need it, when your mind is wandering into unhelpful places. And remember, this is being recorded. If you don't feel up to following along today, you can come back. Just relax, be, and breathe if you'd rather take a pass on this exercise. So in our body, in our nervous system states, we're traveling up and down through states of stress, through states of relaxation, through states of connection, disconnection. And I'll invite you just to notice where you're at right now. Do you feel stimulated, restless? Do you feel tired, like you're shutting down, too much information? Or do you feel somewhere in the middle, a place of safety and connection? We call this our social engagement system. This is when we can perform optimally and connect with others in a way that's useful, skillful. We're in our ability to tend and befriend. And it can be helpful to have resources to turn to when we feel that we're outside of that social engagement system, that place of safety and connection. And I'll walk us through identifying some resources. First, who? Who appears in your mind's eye when you think of someone who is very easy to love? It could be a pet or a spiritual figure, public figure who inspires you. Maybe you'll be surprised by who pops into your consciousness, but just allowing your attention to light upon somebody who is very easy to love, and then to notice what happens in the throat, the heart, the belly. Keep them in your mind's eye. Could be a few people, that's okay. And then just return your attention to throat, heart, belly. And I'll invite you now to think of a where. Where is a location that you go to in your mind that inspires a sense of safety and peace? Seeing it clearly, the elements of earth, air, fire, and water, what colors, what elements are present, what season is it, what's the quality of the light, the temperature of the air. Could be a place in your imagination, but just naming and visualizing, if you can, this where. Any of this feels too challenging, just be and breathe. Return to your feet, your seat, your breath. Look out the window. If you're continuing along with me, the invitation to turn your attention to a when. When is a time in your memory that brings a smile to your face? What was happening? Identifying your when. And if it's difficult to find a when, maybe it's a not yet. Maybe it's still coming. Maybe there's a place, a time in your imagination to turn your attention to. And finally, what's your what? What is a personal object or element from the natural world that immediately brings a sense of ease? Might be a special rock or keepsake, favorite painting, a chair, a sweater, a thing, a tree or a fountain in your backyard, something that offers you this sense of ease and comfort when you think of it. And once again, tuning into the sensation in your body. And to bring this practice to a close, I'll invite you to swiftly and gently, we'll go through our who, our where, our when, our what, reminding yourself of your who, your where, your when, and your what. Notice the quality of your breath. Your mind, your heart state, drop the shoulders, the jaw. Open your eyes. Maybe you want to take a moment to jot these down so you can come back to them when you need them. I'm going to look in the chat. So, how was that for you? Did that evoke anything in your nervous system? Was it soothing? Was it challenging? I'd love to hear any experiences that came up for you as we practice cultivating some positive, connective, nervous system states in your body. Thank you, Donna. I appreciate you. I know these Wednesdays can maybe be a little more practice oriented, but I just felt called to share some of this info today. So I hope that it's of benefit in some way. I have one more practice to offer at the end, but I want to make some space for Q&A and sharing now. We'll practice with mudita at the end, one of my favorite practices. But just yeah, are there any questions or anything I can clarify? We had some good discussion earlier, but I'm here for it. Oh, NH, that's a direct message. I'm not going to say anything. I feel you. Sharon, offering that it was peaceful. Yeah, this is a nice one to turn to. And at my desk in my office, I keep this incredible heart rock I found during the pandemic with my family. We rented an RV and we, how old were my kids? I don't know. It's been a long time now. Isn't that weird, everybody? Like 6 or almost 7 years ago now, you know? And for my kids, it feels longer because they were so much younger, what, 13 and whatever. I'm bad at math. We were hiking on the Continental Divide and we found this rock. And I was pretty terrified at that time. Like, what the hell? Sorry, I'm swearing. But what's going on? Like, are we gonna be okay? I'm kind of in that state from time to time still, if I'm honest. But this heart serves as a reminder of like, hey, you're gonna make it through this thing. And you're with your family on the Continental Divide, and here's a heart for you. So this is one of my what's, but I keep these things near me for soothing. I know, Donna, most of us are terrified a lot these days. I'm glad you're having good feelings. Paula felt throat and heart open up immediately when thinking of her pup. Yeah, Ronald, there's this theory called polyvagal theory, and it's Stephen Porges' theory. And it might be interesting to go to the Polyvagal Institute's website because Stephen has made a statement about it. But there's a group of scientists who have, I think they've more taken task with the neurobiological components of the theory rather than the practices for soothing. But I won't go too deep into it because I am not that well informed myself about the controversy. I just know from a little, I read Stephen Porges' statement, therapists out here all up in arms because it's like this theory that everyone's been using. Like, this is one of my favorite books, honestly. It's called The Polyvagal Theory in Therapy by Deb Dana. And anyway, but so to have a theory that's like widely celebrated be debunked or be, in the crosshairs of it's not real, is interesting. Let's just see. But I'll write it in the chat so you can investigate on your own if you're curious. And it's one of those like psychology theories that I think has gotten a lot of like pop psychology interests, and people do nervous system hacks on Instagram from polyvagal theory, like maybe not being that well educated on it. So anyway, I just wanted to say that there's some issues with it. It's called polyvagal. Thank you, Gwyneth. Polybavel. That's just my lisp. Polyvagal. thanks for sharing that, Gwyneth. Yeah. Well, since there's a natural pause, I'm gonna put my contact information in the chat, but I really invite anyone to chime in or chat in more questions or reflections. I'm gonna put my website in here. And one of my favorite things that my practice or my business has as a part of it is this thing called the Collective Care Club. And whenever I do a UCLA sit, I give memberships for free to this thing with this code that I'm about to put in here. So as a thank you for your kind attention and being here today, and really just because I love practicing in community and cultivating collective care. We need co-regulation on a mass scale to help us feel fortified to keep going. So that's what the Collective Care Club's all about. It's a mindfulness practice community, and there's a lot of support and care inside of these groups. It's called the Collective Care Club. You can find it on my website, and if you want to sign up totally free for forever, if you put this code in, CCC-free, and then just to make so you know what you're signing up for, you will get emails unless you ask not to, but reminding you there are daily sits, 15-minute sits on Monday. No, I do a Monday Metta. It's at noon PT, 1 MT, and we practice different we practice with compassion, mudita, equanimity, and loving kindness every Monday. Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, there's a 6:45 PT AM sit, 7:45 mountain sit, just 15 minutes, different facilitators. And then on Friday at 9:15 mountain, 8:15 Pacific, I do a 15-minute sit also, and you get like a reminder. There's a sit on Sunday too with another teacher. But if you're looking for more community, more care for yourself, that's what it's for. And I would love to see you there. The website is up above, Donna. It's hellowellness.center. It's a little weird because it says dot center at the end instead of dot com, but that is actually a website. So yeah, and if you go to the website, there's all kinds of good stuff to practice together. Retreats, classes, blah, blah, blah. I have a yoga class on Monday afternoons that you can practice online, and it's mindful movement, and I bring in mindful teachings and nervous system stuff. So yeah, I'd love for you to join any and all of these things. All right, I don't think there are any more questions. We can do another little practice to finish. I'm going to bring the screen up again, although I will turn it off at the very end so we can wave goodbye. But one more share. So just to give the poly of all of the immeasurables, these heart practices, metta is loving kindness, karuna is compassion, equanimity is upeka, upekkha, I think, upeka, upeka, and mudita is this feeling of vicarious joy. Many of us are familiar with Schadenfreude, this feeling of like, oh, I revel in your misery, vicarious joy. And that's actually, we have that feeling because of our evolutionary biology, feeling like there's not enough to go around. There's scarcity. If I don't get the walnuts, somebody else will. So when they don't get the walnuts, I'm a little relieved and happy. This is not so pro-social. Mudita is a practice that really helps us counter this sense of scarcity, to be able to hype others up, to be able to feel joy when others are happy and are celebrating. We need more of this in this world. I really think this is one of the most beautiful but also most challenging practices, to actually feel joy at another's success, another's achievements, another's happiness. So this is a mudita practice. This is a classic mudita phrases to practice with. So I'll invite us all, and it may be challenging in this moment, and you're welcome to pass and breathe yet again. Come back to this recording another time when you feel up for it. If you're following along, maybe a hand on the heart, a hand on the diaphragm, or anywhere else it feels nourishing to amplify connection to your own heart, your own sense of love and compassion and care and wish for the well-being of others. Offering up this working theory that happiness too can be contagious. And when we witness another person in joy and happiness, it can light up our heart. And these phrases can help us cultivate this. So I invite you to think of someone who's celebrating, who has some joy in their life, or even a time where you were witnessing an accomplishment, someone achieving a long wished for goal, or your favorite team winning the championship, you name it. I invite you to bring this person, this experience to mind, to see them clearly in your mind's eye, and to offer them the following wishes. May you be happy. May your happiness continue. May you appreciate your joy. I'm happy for you. Breathing in to whatever this evokes in your heart, for whatever is here, offering this to kindness. Staying with the feeling of your hands rising and falling with your breath. This too, all of it, the joy, the sorrow, the appreciation, the hope. May you be happy. May your happiness continue. May you appreciate your joy. I'm happy for you. Breathing that in, breathing that out, and a final loving kindness wish. May everyone everywhere and everything without exception be free from suffering. May we all be well. May we all be safe and protected. May we all have what we need. Once again, may everyone, everywhere, everything, without exception, be free from suffering. Thanks for your presence, everyone. Thank you for being here.
Thanks for listening to the UCLA Mindful Weekly Lecture. For more information about our classes, workshops, and retreats, please visit uclahealth.org/UCLA Mindful. Join us each week for a new session on mindfulness. This is the UCLA Mindful Weekly Lecture. Each week, Diana Winston, or one of our UCLA Mindful teachers, offers a talk about mindfulness to deepen our understanding and cultivate well-being. Thanks for joining us.